Thank you very much indeed, Nick, and thank you to Nick and Grant and Vincent and everybody who's certainly given me a very warm aperist with welcome so far. What I'll be talking about today, before I go any further, can you actually hear me? Yeah. What I'm going to be talking about today is, I'm going to start off talking about something that's in the book, an extraordinary episode and one which stands further scrutiny than it's had already, and then I'm going to be going on to through a deft link to what's on my mind at the moment, and hopefully we'll end up looking at the Europe that we can all recognise today. But, it starts off here, Christmas 1914. One of the most poignant images of the Great War, the Christmas truces, in which German and British soldiers on the Western Front left their trenches to exchange gifts, sing carols, and play football. It said the Germans won 3-2. This romantic portrayal, which was contemporary, shows that the episode at the time was seen through lenses similar to those which it's seen today. For a contrasting perspective, this photo that was taken at the time suggests that the reality was tougher and bleaker. Today, much of the poignancy of the Christmas truces arises from the contrast between this unique moment and the mass slaughter that the Western Front signifies. But that wasn't the whole of what took place on the Western Front. For long periods, along miles of the line, hostilities were muted. What was unique about the Christmas truces was that they were open, overt truces, but they weren't the end of non-aggression pacts. Extended covert truces were maintained by agreements, often tacit, sometimes explicit, between soldiers facing each other across no man's land. In the words of British sociologist Tony Ashworth, who wrote a book about this much later, about 1980, the troops established what he called live-and-let-live systems. These arrangements probably began by accident. Ashworth suggests, for instance, that soldiers on one side would have observed that things went quiet when the other side was eating its meals, and they would fairly readily have worked out that that it might be to their advantage to refrain from attacking during meal times in order to have a sort of guaranteed period of peace and quiet in which they too could eat their meal without being shelled or sniped at. This action inevitably is a signal. It's not simply it has value as an act of communication as well as of pragmatic self-interest. Those soldiers were in effect signalling to the other side that they were prepared to cooperate in the pursuit of their shared interest in staying alive. Having inadvertently discovered a mutual interest in temporary ceasefires, soldiers then manipulated the means at their disposal to send signals that developed these live-and-let-live systems. Of course, the means most obviously to hand in that situation is gunfire. That was their job. They were there to fire at the enemy. They couldn't simply not fire at the enemy because that would have obviously been recognised by senior officers and identified as mutiny. In fact, this is actually what happened later on in the war when French forces en masse declared that they were going to remain in their trenches but they weren't going to go on what they regarded as futile raids. That was seen as a revolt and eventually was suppressed. In the earlier days, in a, perhaps you might say, almost a quieter period of the war, it was easier for the soldiers to manipulate the situation. Okay, so they had to look busy. They had to fire their weapons. But they would send signals, for instance, by firing their weapons, firing artillery at an obviously empty patch of land, or firing at predictable times of day so that the other side knew when to keep their heads down. Tony Ashworth observes that the constant flow of ritualised violence allowed each antagonist to know the other's current mood as well as to predict with some confidence his future behaviour. So this is actually a nuanced system, despite being conducted with high explosives. One group of German snipers demonstrated their marksmanship by aiming at a derelict building on the other side of the line and doing the sort of thing that you perhaps have seen in a Western film or a cartoon where they fire in a circle on, against a wall until the circle, the holes join up and the and a disc of masonry falls out of the wall. The game theorist Robert Axelrod, who analysed this live and let live system in his book The Evolution of Cooperation, shrewdly observed that a display like this helped police the system by showing that restraint was not due to weakness. In other words, if they wanted to kill the enemy, they would kill the enemy. And by implication, if the enemy broke the ceasefire, yes, they would be killed. By establishing their competence, and this is a key element in trust, competence, they made their intentions clear. Trust is always about, always has these two components. Trust in the ability of whoever it is that you're trusting to do what it is you're trusting them to do, and trust in their motivation, their intention to do so. Axelrod saw in Tony Ashworth's account a striking real-world instance of the kind of problem known to game theorists as the prisoner's dilemma. The dilemma for each player in a game like this is that the risk that the other player will cheat prevents them from cooperating. If they cooperated, they'd have a good outcome. But when they work through what the other party is likely to do in their minds, they come to the conclusion that they can't trust them, and so they end up with an outcome that is worse for both of them. If there's only one round in such a game, if there's only one decision to be made, you can't establish cooperation. But if it's a situation that continues, what's known as an iterated prisoner's dilemma, where the same choices are presented over and over again, it's possible to use the information that you gain from each round of the game to develop a strategy that allows cooperation to persist. Axelrod famously ran a series of computer tournaments a long time ago. Computers were very simple in those days. And the winning strategy, the one that couldn't really be beaten, was called, it's very simple, it was called tit for tat. The rule was simply, on the first round, you cooperate. And then on each successive go, you do what the other player did. So if the other player cooperates, then you cooperate. If the other player defects, like cheats, then you do too. And that's the end of that. Clearly, this is not a situation in which there is any trust involved whatsoever. I mean, this computer software is not capable of trusting. And Axelrod himself saw the live and let live system as an example in which trust, in which cooperation evolved without needing trust. I see this differently, because if you read Axelrod's Ashworth's anecdotes, observations, quotes about how those soldiers responded to these truces, it becomes clear that almost without them wanting to, they start to trust. And if one thinks about the dynamics of the situation, it becomes very hard to see how on earth you could have a prolonged ceasefire under these literally noisy conditions without an element of trust. Bearing in mind that soldiers on each side have to use their weapons. They are always going to have to look busy, and sometimes they are going to have to attack in earnest in order to avoid openly defying their commander's orders. That situation needs trust because it requires that, in particular, that you go into you imagine what's going on in the minds of the people on the other side, and you think, why are they doing that? And you're inclined to put a to create a positive interpretation of their actions. So, if there is a salvo of shells, you are ready to say, that must be another unit, soldiers acting under orders that they can't avoid. The conditions that permitted cooperation undoubtedly provided a basis for trust. I take my cue in all these things from the political scientist Russell Hardin, who has, from which we can get this wonderful, to my mind, wonderful definition of trust. It's based on self-interest and perceptions about the interests of the other and how the two are related together. We're using this definition, using this understanding of trust. You can very readily see just how easily trust can emerge from the most apparently unpromising relationships. Trust arises most naturally when you believe that your interests are shared by the other party. So in the trenches, it arose because of the stalemate. It wasn't that the soldiers discovered universal brotherhood. They didn't all start saying, as a left-wing slogan of the time had it, a bayonet is a weapon with a worker on each end. Certainly on the British side, there seems no sign that they were politically radicalised in that kind of a way. It seems most likely that their preference, in the language of game theory, was that they would like to defeat the enemy, but they realised that wasn't possible, so they went to their next preference, which is don't die. And in that preference, they shared an interest with the men on the other side. It could have been the germ of trust that within the constraints of the situation, the men opposite would incorporate their interests in survival into the actions that they took to provide, to preserve their own lives. To have confidence, excuse me, I do have a bottle of Benelin, which I may have to resort to at some point in the presentation. I'll try and get through it. To have confidence in one's predictions about another's behaviour, though, it helps to feel that one has plenty in common with them. The more that one shares beliefs, culture and manners, the easier it is to judge how somebody's likely to behave by simply asking, well, what would I do if I were them? Soldiers on the German side in particular seem to have been remarkably sensitive to the importance of feelings of kinship and shared culture. Ashworth's account actually doesn't seem to give many examples where the British worked on that side of the relationship, but the Germans certainly did. Some of them would call out, in where their lines were close enough together to permit it, they would call out to ask about English Football League results, which not only reminded them that they shared a major cultural interest in football, but also reminded the British how many Germans had actually worked in Britain, and particularly London, before the war. That's actually reflected in a joke from the British side, which alludes to the stereotype that Germans in London worked as waiters, for like sort of the Polish plumber, or I suppose the Asian shopkeeper, as the German waiter. There's a joke that a British soldier would call out, "Waiter!" 50 voices on the other side would shout, "Coming, sir." There's was a remarkable degree of ingenuity and shown by certain soldiers. One group who had a mortar at their disposal took the warhead off and replaced it with a note, which they fired across the line, and the note said, "We could send you newspapers by this method if you like." I don't think they took up the opportunity to receive the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung or whatever it was. One of the most remarkable aspects of one of the remarkable features of what you could call trench popular culture were the musical machine gunners. This became quite a sort of sport in certain parts of the line. Machine gunners learned how to rap out the rhythms of popular songs in bursts of gunfire, and one of them was a song called "The Policeman's Holiday," which is a big hit in I think about 1916, and still just about remembered today, I think, because it has a chorus that goes, "Steady boys, here comes a copper," and then the last line is, "Good night." And who said that this machine gunner, who was nicknamed Happy Harry, could do the "Steady boys, here comes a copper," and when he did that, two shots would be fired by soldiers on both sides of the line to do the "good night" bit. On one occasion, after German forces fired an unexpected salvo of shells at the British lines, one brave German soldier climbed onto the parapet and called out, "We're very sorry about that. We hope no one was hurt. It's not our fault. It's that damned Prussian artillery." This was very significant. There was a deep-seated antipathy towards the dominant Prussians, because, after all, Germany was an empire, which had only relatively recently unified as a state, and it was dominated by Prussia, to the great resentment of among others, I guess, the Saxons. And the Saxons not only thoroughly disliked the Prussians, and on one occasion a departing Saxon unit that was being rotated out of the line called out to the British soldiers on the other side, "The Prussians coming in, give them hell." These Saxons had this mythic idea of kinship because they thought of the British, specifically the English, as Anglo-Saxons. And of course this went right to the top, because the soldiers that are said to have toasted the English king before the football match in Christmas 1914, the Germans were in fact Saxon soldiers, and they sang "God Save the King," and the king that they were singing, asking God to save, was actually a Saxon. At that time, the British royal family was openly known as the House of Saxe-Coburg-Gotha, and that persisted until 1917, when rising anti-German sentiment on the home front caused them to rebrand themselves as the House of Windsor, which of course they remain. By contrast, the German Kaiser, to whom the Saxons owed their allegiance, was a Prussian. For their part, many British soldiers came to feel that, as one Tommy put it, "Mr. Bosch ain't a bad fellow." Bosch was a derogatory French term for Germans. The sense of sympathy and affinity contrasted starkly with the way that the enemy was portrayed at home. The rising tide of anti-German sentiment that I referred to a moment ago is pretty graphically illustrated in this propaganda poster. May I point out to you the bayoneted baby and the ravished woman, the weapon of mass destruction, the poison gas, and a bestial, hateful faces, slightly combination of zombies and some sort of racial kind of thing going on there. the contrast, as this tide of hatred built up at home, with the attitudes, the tolerant attitudes, Mr. Bosch ain't such a bad fellow, on the line, shows how distance seemed to be absolutely critical to this. What you seem to get was a situation in which two groups of men, a couple of hundred metres apart perhaps, or maybe a lot closer actually, saw themselves as closer in interests than they felt towards their high command, and probably towards the people they'd left behind on the home front. I should just quickly say something about the basis of this. So Ashworth points out that in order to get, because these were conspiracies, and in order to get a truce conspiracy going, you need a certain amount you need two things. You need size and you need stability. So size, by size I mean that there's no good, I mean, you know, to take it to its absurd conclusion, there's no point in one man going on a truce because the man next to him is likely to shoot anybody who pops their head up. And also, non-aggression has to be on a big enough scale to be noticed by the other side. Stability is important because this is, in the technical language, an iterated prisoner dilemma, and the people involved in it have to be able to observe the behaviour of the group on the other side for long enough for this to be confident that this is a sound and safe system for them. And in fact, it was actually the British Army, certainly on the British side, it was the British Army's own particular way of building comradeship that permitted this system to evolve, because the battalion was absolutely right, several hundred soldiers, big enough to be noticed, not so big that high command would necessarily notice. And this solidarity had long been the basis of how the British Army built up its sense of comradeship. As observed by Dan Todman, a young historian of the First World War, that one of the reasons why the British soldiers didn't seem to blame their superiors ultimately, or the politicians back home, for their predicament, was that they just had such narrow horizons. They were completely bound up with their own battalion. That was where it all stopped. However, that structure was also pretty much the only one that was going to work in that situation. And eventually, the British High Command worked out how to defeat it. There'd always been small trench raids, but it was generally possible for these to be accommodated within the truce system. In other words, they didn't do too much harm. They could be attributed to other units or whatever. Eventually, the High Command instituted a large-scale raiding policy involving up to a couple of hundred men. And again, size was critical here, because raids on this kind of scale caused casualties and damage that couldn't be ignored within the implicit terms for ceasefire. And the other critical thing about it was that they broke up the battalion structure. They put together these raiding parties from lots of different units, so any conspiracy was unravelled. They couldn't possibly extend it across a sort of temporary coalition of men drawn from different units. Anyway, in Britain, historical memory has come to cherish the men of the Great War, more so as the very last of them came to the ends of their very long lives during the past few months. But here the war is remembered almost exclusively as the trench conflict of northwestern France and in Belgium. But it was a world war, and it was certainly a pan-European war. Its most profound effects were in the East. Here the two central powers, the German Empire and the Austro-Hungarian Empire, fought the Russian Empire. And they harnessed many nations to their war machines, being empires. And after they collapsed, as a result of the First World War, they left many new nations on the map. And this man, who's photographed on leave in 1916, is indistinguishable in his uniform from hundreds of thousands of other soldiers who served in the German ranks. But he wasn't German, he was Polish. I know this because this is a family photo and this is my grandfather. Unfortunately, I don't... it would be rather neat if I had pictures of my other grandfather with the ethnic and artillery theme, because he was an Irishman who served in the British Royal Horse Artillery. At the time that my grandfather posed for these photos, Poland was divided between the three great powers, as it had been since they divided it up at the end of the 18th century. Yet 2 years later, he was living in a newly independent Polish state, known as the Second Polish Republic. And so, 1918, Poland's back on the map, right in the middle of Europe. Heaven help it. 20 years after that, my grandfather found himself back in Germany. In a secret protocol to the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact of August 1939, Germany and the Soviet Union agreed to divide the nation between them. And they did so the following month, the Wehrmacht invading on September the 1st and the Red Army on September the 17th. Subsequently, the Nazis annexed much of Poland to the Reich. So they took all that bit, and the part that they didn't annex, they ruled with an occupation government. It wasn't a puppet state, it was a Nazi occupation government. Today's Polish state is called the Third Republic. Here it is. Back on the map and still in the middle of Europe, though it has moved to the left. Poland did actually reappear in the end of the First World War within these boundaries, but such is the feeling in Poland about the communist period that Polish republics go from the second one, which was destroyed in 1939, straight to the third one, which was established in 1989. The Polish People's Republic is not considered to have been an independent state. The way I've just told this synopsis of Polish history, featuring two 20-year periods of independence in two centuries, is the way the Poles are used to telling it. They draw lessons from it as well. The significance of these is not that they're accepted wholeheartedly throughout society, but that at some level they're generally recognised. Now, the point I'm making here is that you see this most strongly on the nationalist right, which has much in common with nationalist right-wing tendencies throughout East Central Europe. But to me, the significance of those beliefs, those ideologies, is that they are concentrated versions of propositions that at some level get a degree of assent throughout the societies in which they are a layer of opinion. They're deeply felt as national sentiments. One of these beliefs is that freedom, which in the Polish context means national independence above all, is always precarious. The security of an independent Polish state cannot ever be taken for granted. Dariusz Gawin of the Warsaw Rising Museum put it very starkly, but not, I think, uncharacteristically, claiming that this existential anxiety